This week, we are talking about the economic forces that demand Bitcoin's ascent to a global form of money with one of the brightest minds in the space. Dr. Saifedean Ammous is the author of The Bitcoin Standard and a number of other books, as well as being one of my favorite personalities in the space. This is a deep dive into hard money, economics, and all things Bitcoin, and I hope you enjoy. All right. Welcome to another episode of the Block Reward Podcast. Very special guest this week for our 100th episode. A humongous fan of Dr. Saifedean Ammous, author of many books, including The Bitcoin Standard, host of the Bitcoin Standard Podcast. What else? Professor?
Yeah, I teach economics on my website, saifedean.com.
And it's funny, I tell these stories. You start out with a list of people, maybe when you start a Bitcoin podcast, of guests you'd love to have on, and I think you're the last name on my list, so I thrilled to have you here today. I've seen you on a number of different platforms discuss the idea of people, the biggest kind of mistake that they make with Bitcoin is misunderstanding its economic principles, which is really your wheelhouse. And I wonder if we could just start there with how you might characterize what that mistake is, what are the economic principles of Bitcoin that are so confusing or beyond the average person who hasn't looked into it yet?
Yeah, I think, well, I mean, it's a giant minefield of potential mistakes that people make, and spend some time in this field, you see a lot of these mistakes all over the place, and you see the remnants and the ashes and the remains of all the people falling victim to these mistakes. There are many of them. If I were to begin, I would say the first one is an inability to understand Bitcoin as just being money and fixating on it having to offer a yield. So one of the most common ones is, I'm not just going to buy Bitcoin. It doesn't offer a yield. There's no company there. There's nobody there. I don't know who's behind it. And how can I be sure that it's going to be around next year? I can just buy Apple stock. I can buy Nvidia. I can buy Netflix. I can invest in these companies. You know, there's a CEO who gets on TV. He looks nice. He's clean shaven. And he doesn't say crazy, nasty, anarchist things like all these crazy Bitcoiners do. And that's a lot more reassuring. And also there are returns to investing in these companies. They offer you a yield. You know, they sell a product, they make money, and then they give you a return. But with Bitcoin, there is no product being sold. There are no services being offered in exchange for cash. So there's no cash flow. And so if there's no cash flow, then clearly it must be a Ponzi scheme. And I think this is a huge, huge mistake. This is probably the biggest mistake that people make, which is no cash flow. Therefore, this has got to be a scam. But I would beg to differ. What defines a Ponzi scheme is the fact that the shares in the Ponzi scheme are constantly being increased. So you're constantly bringing in more and more people to join in the pie of the economic value that is in the Ponzi scheme, in the pyramid scheme. So we start off with some people putting in money, and then we get more people, and then those people have shares and claims on that money. And as long as we're not getting in cash flow, then every new person putting money in is contributing money, but they're diluting the share of all the existing people. And so then you've got more claims than you have actual cash on board because you're promising people returns. And so therefore, eventually that blows up. At some point, more people withdraw cash than there is cash left, and you can't give cash to people. But with Bitcoin, it's different because we're not offering anybody any return. So there is no cash flow. And there are no returns. Nobody's telling you that there's going to be any return on it. It's just an asset that appreciates over time. But it appreciates because there are no returns. And so people are just holding it for its own sake. And that's not some crazy, unique idea that Bitcoin has invented. This is money. This is what every money in history has always been. This is what gold was like. This is what silver was like. This is what the dollar itself is like. This is what seashells and glass beads are like. That's what money is. Everybody buys into this thing and they buy it as a money. So they increase the demand for it beyond just the demand for it as an economic good. So people are buying gold or silver or seashells or glass beads, not because those things are useful to them in their market function or in their industrial use, they're buying it as money. They're buying it purely as a medium of exchange. They're buying it to hold on to it for a day or a month or a year or 10 years and then to pass it off to somebody else. So this is what a medium of exchange is. It offers no cash flow. It doesn't offer a yield, but it holds on to its value. So why do people pick something like this? Then you start to ask a question of what is money? And for that, I've written a whole book for you. It's called The Bitcoin Standard. So I highly recommend that. But in a nutshell, if you look at what makes money historically, I argue that money is always whatever is the hardest to make at any point in time, at any place in time. You look around at whatever is the hardest liquid good to produce more of, that ends up becoming money. And that happens whether people recognize that that is what they're doing or whether they don't recognize it. It's irrelevant whether they do, because ultimately, if people choose to use something that is easy as money, then more and more of that thing is going to be created, and then that thing is going to lose its value. So everybody who used it as a money will lose the value that they stored into it. So things that are easy to make will not acquire economic value beyond their market industrial utility use case. So that's why copper is not going to make it as money. Nickel, iron, tomatoes, oranges, all of those things are very easy to make. So if you buy them and you choose to use them as a form of money, well, the more you buy them, the more you raise the price. And then the more you raise the price, the more you incentivize the people to produce them, who can produce them, to produce more of them. So they're going to produce more of them. They're going to sell it on the market. They're going to benefit from the fact that you've raised the price for that. And they're going to bring the price down. And so you will lose. So wealth will only stick around in money that is hard to make. And so you look at any society, you find that the form of money that they use is always something that is difficult to make, not because they study economics, not because they had Austrian economics books to read, and just because of the brutal economic reality of selection. And that's just how it is. The hardest money is going to end up being the money that everybody is using.
There's, I think, a number of different like fogs around, inflation and soft money, and because Bitcoin also sort of combines hardness of money with hardness of asset. I feel like we've been in this fiat experiment just long enough that people don't really think of money as being a desirable good in and of itself. And so this idea about people using the hardest money as a store of value extends into other asset classes. And I wonder if you could just maybe share a few of your thoughts on the monetization of Bitcoin, where this, you know, can go.
Yeah. So the fact is that a big part of the reason that people don't understand this discussion that I was making about money, which I think a century ago would have been a lot more intuitive for people because they used gold as money. And so therefore they understood that the scarcity of gold, the difficulty of producing gold is what makes it a good money, because it holds on to its value and it doesn't depreciate over time. So therefore you use it to save. And so therefore you earn money and you put that money in gold, and you earn the money in gold. You held that gold and you waited over time. And then you knew that 5 years, 10 years later, that money would have maintained its value, if not appreciated a little bit. And this was pretty straightforward. Well, that's not the case with the money that we have today. Our money today is broken. It's worse than just broken. It's built to rob you, basically. So it's losing its value every year at around 5, 6, 7, 10% or so, depending on where you are in the world. Your money is robbing you. And so therefore, you don't keep hold of your money. We've learned over a brutal century of money losing its value, banks going bankrupt, governments confiscating people's bank accounts, all of the, you know, governments defaulting on their bonds. We've learned that government money is unsafe. And so you don't save money. I mean, this is one of the most important things that you learn. One of the key steps that people need to take in order to become financially successful in the modern world is getting over the grandma's wisdom of always save money. The grandmas usually are very right. And in fact, you know, that they are correct on this one. It's just that the world is broken. They're not wrong. The world is wrong. The money is wrong. But if you follow your grandma's advice and you spend less than you earn and you save the difference, you're going to go broke. because your money is going to be losing value all the time. So you need to stop saving and you need to find a way of taking risk with your money so that you can make a return. That's why people don't get the concept of just holding money. As I was mentioning earlier, they think you need to go chase a yield. You need to make a return because if you just hold money, it loses value. So when you tell them Bitcoin goes up without you having to make a return, it just short circuits. It doesn't register. You got to go buy stocks, buy bonds, gamble on commodities, you know, read some press release masquerading as a research piece about some commodity or the other that's going to shoot up. And so you go and you speculate on palladium or nickel or copper or something or the other. And you think that in a year or two, it's going to work out. And so you're out there gambling with all of these different financial assets that exist and trying to make a positive return in real terms, not just in nominal terms, in terms of dollars, but also in real terms. And that's very difficult. And the result of that is that instead of just holding on to money, people are out there speculating with all of those assets. So therefore, these assets are constantly getting inflated and becoming more and more expensive, which has enormous tragic ramifications. I think the most obvious one is that people use their homes as saving accounts. And so everybody is, you know, encouraged to get into debt for a house. And this is really very wise in the fiat economy. You're much better off getting into debt to buy a house than you are to save money in order to buy the house eventually. Because if you're saving money, the house is becoming a lot more expensive every year. You think the house is getting expensive. The house is not getting expensive. The house is getting, the house is probably staying the same. It's just your money that's losing value. Well, to be fair, no, the house is getting a little bit more expensive. Because A, your money is losing value. So everybody else is getting rid of their money as much as they can and buying as much houses as they can because the houses devalue less than the money devalues. So you're out there waiting, you know, you're a young 25-year-old and you want to get married and you and your fiance are thinking about saving up money for buying a house. And you're looking at the house you want to buy and every month it gets more expensive. And the reason is that you're not just up against other 25-year-olds who want to buy this house. You're up against 35 and 45 and 65 and 75 year olds who are looking for saving accounts. They're buying that house to rent it out because that's better than putting money in the bank account. And so therefore, people are just always speculating on all these assets. Stocks are shooting up. Bonds are shooting up, usually not in the last 5-6 years or so, but bonds are going up. You know, all these bubbles are just always popping up everywhere in the market where all of these things go up in value. Because people realize that the dollar, the money, is a hot potato that you need to get rid of. And so because of that, houses continuously get a lot more expensive because people are using them as saving accounts. You're competing with people who are looking for a saving account, not just people who are looking for a home. And so, of course, older people have more money, so they end up buying more and more houses, and that outbids young people. And so young people have to keep renting. And that's why you've got an entire generation now that is getting used to just the idea that they're going to be renting for a very long time. They may never be able to buy homes because they can't compete with the 60 and 70 year olds who are buying those homes to rent them out because that's better use of money than putting it in a bank account. Fortunately, Bitcoin fixes this because now the 50 and 60 and 70 year olds are going to realize that house is nowhere near as good an investment as just buying Bitcoin. You look at the performance of real estate over the last 5-6 years, you compare it to the performance of Bitcoin, not just the 5-6 years, you know, since Bitcoin has existed, and you see Bitcoin does a lot better. So you're better off just going out there and buying Bitcoin and let the young people buy their homes so that they can live in them. I think this is one of the great things about Bitcoin. It's going to demonetize real estate. People are going to stop using real estate as money. And that's going to make homes cheaper for people who need them.
I hope so. I agree with you there. I wonder then, so how should people, you know, we've got these parallel phenomenon where Bitcoin is, it is increasing in value as sort of there is an increasing demand juxtaposed against a finite supply, but the dollar, as you mentioned, is becoming less valuable, 5, 8, 10% per year. How does someone who's trying to understand this phenomenon as a new person or an outsider make sense of what is really happening with the value of Bitcoin today?
I think the way to understand the valuation of anything is through supply and demand. And so the key thing with Bitcoin is that its supply is fixed. there's only ever going to be 21 million Bitcoins. About 19.8, I think, or so have already been produced now. I think maybe 19.9 million of these have been produced. So more than 93 or 94% have already been produced. So they're out in circulation. The last 1.1 million or so are going to be produced over the next 100 years or so. So the annual supply growth rate of Bitcoin today is about 0.8%. Every year it drops by half. Every year daily production of Bitcoin drops by half. So initially, when Bitcoin was first created, it was making 7,200 Bitcoin a day, every day. And then for the next 4 years, it was making 3,600. And then the next 4 years was 1,800. The next 4 years was 900. And this current four-year period, which started last year, we are making 450 coins a day. So that adds up to about a 0.8% supply growth rate per year, which is about a tenth of what the best fiat currencies do. So the dollar, the euro, the yen, the Swiss franc, these are the best performing fiat national government currencies. And their supply increases at around 8, 7, 9% per year over the last 60 years or so, if you take the average. So that's a pretty huge difference. You know, every year you're making 8% more dollars, but every year currently we're only making 0.8% more Bitcoin. And then in 3 years' time, it's going to be 0.4%. And then in another 3 years, it'll be 0.2%, and so on and so forth. So the supply grows at a very small rate compared to other currencies. And so that necessarily implies that it's going to hold on to its value better. Even if demand for Bitcoin stays constant, you're going to expect that the value of Bitcoin is going to shoot up because, you know, this, if the daily demand for Bitcoin is the same over the next 4 years, at some point the daily supply is going to drop by half and there's not going to be enough demand to go around for the new, enough supply to go around for the new demand. So the only way to meet the extra new demand is for the price to go up. But the demand's not going to be the same because once people understand that the supply is constant, they realize, okay, well, this thing's going to go up, so I want to get in on it. And so the more people get in on it, the more the price goes up. And this is where we are. You know, this is essentially the thesis of my book that I wrote 8 years ago now. And it's held up pretty well, if I may say so myself. The price then was about $7,000. And at that point, it seemed like a miracle. How did this thing go from under $1 per Bitcoin to more than $7,000 per Bitcoin? And the point of my book was, you ain't seen nothing yet. It's just going to keep going up more and more and more. And indeed, it has been going up more and more. And it's now at, what, 115 or so? 115,000. So from 7,000 to 115,000 is pretty enormous increase. And so I think that's just going to be the same. It's going to be the same into the future because unless you can figure out a way to make more Bitcoin, unless you can destroy that value proposition, which is nobody can make more, then there's just going to be more and more demand and the demand is going to grow. And now here people will say, well, that just seems unsustainable. Eventually, at some point, people stop buying it. And the answer is no. Why? You could say the same thing about Manhattan real estate. You could say the same thing about gold. You could say the same thing about tomatoes. You could say the same thing about computers. Why would people tomorrow wake up and just realize, nope, we don't want to use computers anymore? I mean, if that happens, yeah, Apple would go to zero and Nvidia would go to zero and Amazon would go to zero. If the whole world decides they don't want to use any more electronic equipment, then yes, the entire electronics and technology industry will go to zero. The whole world decides they don't want to live in New York anymore, then yes, Manhattan real estate will go to zero. But there's no reason to imagine that. Manhattan real estate does what it does and people like what it does. And it's going to, there will continue to be people who want it. And similarly with Bitcoin, it holds on to its value. So more and more people are going to want in on this thing because you can't make more of it. You can't inflate it. So there's no reason for it to be unsustainable. On the contrary, what we're seeing is that this thing is just becoming money. That's how money becomes money. People hold on to something. And then I remember what I was saying at the beginning of this discussion. What ends up being money is the thing that is the hardest to make. So because people hold on to it, they don't even need to understand what is going on. They just see that this thing is holding on to its value well. And other things aren't. So I'm going to hold on to the thing that holds on to value if I want to keep value to the future. And so that means the thing that people use as a store of value, the thing that people hold, the thing in which they hold their cash balances, that becomes the dominant form of cash balance over time because it appreciates. And so therefore, because they have big cash balances in it, they'll start trading with it. So once my cash balance in Bitcoin exceeds my cash balances in other things, I'm more likely to want to trade with people with Bitcoin. And so over time, I become more and more of a Bitcoin person in that I buy and sell things with Bitcoin. And that's beneficial to me because my Bitcoin holds on to its value. So more and more people learn this, more and more people witness their cash balances in Bitcoin go up. Eventually, Bitcoin eats all of the cash balances in the world and it becomes the money of the world. And, you know, I've been saying this for a long time and I'm waiting for people to come up with a compelling counter argument for why at a certain point this thing will stop. And I've not seen any. I think it's just going to, as long as you can't find a way to make more Bitcoin, then Bitcoin is going to continue to go up and eventually it's going to become bigger than all of the world's cash balances, at which point it becomes the most important money, in my opinion, and it becomes the world's money.
What is that number, to put you on the spot?
That's a great question.
300 trillion. I mean, Bitcoin has become 2 trillion-ish asset right now.
Yeah, it's well, I think by current standards, I would estimate that the market for money is what people hold as cash balances. And I'd estimate that at something in the range of 300 trillion. Michael Saylor, Jack Mahler's like to say 400, 500 trillion. You know, I'm conservative. I'm saying it's only 300 trillion. Because what I count for that is all of the world's fiat monies. So if you count all of the value of the dollars and all the other currencies that are out there, and then if you count the value of government bonds, I think that's also a form of cash balance because people hold on to government bonds these days as a form of cash. They don't buy bonds because they, you know, they're looking to speculate. They're not trying to make a quick buck with bonds. They buy them for their safety and security to hold on to value over time, or at least what they think. Obviously, they've gotten shafted over the past few years by doing that. But that is basically something along the lines of a cash replacement. So that's about another $100 trillion. So that's $200 trillion so far. You've got gold, which is about $30 trillion. And then I would say significant chunks of the world's stock markets and the world's real estate is held as cash rather than as an investment or as a consumer good. You know, people aren't just buying homes because they want to live in them. And they're not buying homes because they're looking to become real estate investors for the sake of investing and trying to make more money. Essentially, they're just doing it to hold on to the value that they already have. So I think a big chunk of that demand, and you know, part of the demand for stocks is like, you know, the passive investing, people just buy indexes, people who aren't really looking to take risk on companies they don't understand, but they do it because it's the way to beat the to beat inflation. I think all of that eventually finds its way, or a big chunk of that finds its way into Bitcoin. So we're talking about a $300 trillion market. But you know, that's the total addressable market. But I think there comes a tipping point significantly before that, at which point Bitcoin becomes the world's biggest single money. That, I think, is a big deal. So currently we've got something like $30 trillion in US dollars, and then we have another $30 trillion in US dollar treasuries. And you could count these as being the same thing. It's the same kind of shitcoin, if you want to call it. I think that's really the, at that point, once you dethrone that as the biggest money, then I would imagine the rest of it is essentially a foregone conclusion. I think at this point, you're just waiting for the checkered flag to show up. You're doing victory laps almost. Because once Bitcoin becomes bigger than all the other monies, then you've got this global liquid asset that is available for everybody everywhere. And it's the biggest and it's the best at holding on to its value. And it doesn't have all the kind of risks that are associated with government money. And so therefore, I think at that point, it's won. And then it's just a matter of, you know, the finalizing the technicalities of the victory. So, I mean, I used to say $30 trillion the size of the US Treasury bond market, but I think it's probably more accurate now that I think about it. Probably more accurate to say $60 trillion when you add in the US dollar as well, because these are the same market. So, $60 trillion really is the mountain we need to conquer. And then once we conquer that, then it's just a matter of rolling down the hill while eating all the rest of the smaller fish.
So I think that would be like a a $3 million Bitcoin, something like that. Do you think that if we were approaching that size of an asset, we would still be thinking about Bitcoin's price in terms of fiat dollars? Or, you know, how does that work?
Well, it's $3 million in today's dollars. But by the time we get to this, you know, that's another 30x from now, that's likely going to be a much bigger number. Because by the time we get to, say, let's say this happens 5 or 10 years from now, at that point, there's going to be a lot more dollars and a lot more U.S. government debt out there. So in terms of purchasing power, it would be equivalent to $3 million today. But then who knows when that eventually happens, what kind of purchasing power we're talking about. So I'd imagine it would be larger. Now, whether there would still be dollars at that point is a very interesting question. I think ultimately that question is not something that I can predict as some kind of economic phenomenon, because it's going to depend on the decisions of specific human beings who will happen to be in power and in charge of the US dollar at certain points in the future. And I have no way of knowing who those people are and what they're going to be thinking. But at a certain point, once Bitcoin crosses that kind of milestone, or maybe significantly before that, you know, we're going to be in a situation where Bitcoin is appreciating significantly next to the dollar. And at that point, I think it's going to become clear to people that the only way to keep the dollar alive is to keep it pegged to Bitcoin. The only way that you can keep the dollar alive is to just make the dollar a currency that is on a Bitcoin standard, like it used to be on a gold standard, where you were able to redeem your dollars for gold. You could just go to the bank and give them your paper dollars and they give you physical gold. You'd have to do something similar for the dollar with Bitcoin, and you have to make it redeemable in Bitcoin. And I don't think you could get away with the fiat shenanigans that you got away with over the last century with fiat money. That's the topic of my second book, The Fiat Standard, which looks at how fiat money came into being and then to try and understand how Bitcoin could deal with that. And so I think ultimately the reason they were able to impose fiat money and get off the gold standard is that ultimately gold is massively centralized. And so in order to be using it as money, you had to centralize all of the gold in banks and central banks. And then when these guys just told you, hey, no, we're fighting a war, go away, we can't give you gold, you had no choice and you had no recourse for anything. You didn't have an alternative. But Bitcoin gives you an alternative. We can do about 1 million transactions a day outside of just on-chain. Anybody can access it. Currently, it's only a few cents to make an on-chain transaction. And even if it gets to $5 a transaction or $50 a transaction or $5,000 a transaction, it's still going to be worthwhile, because it means, you know, people are going to be able to take their money out of these kind of centralized systems. So I think Bitcoin is much harder to co-opt and turn into fiat. And so therefore, if you're trying to run a dollar fiat money scheme while Bitcoin is the biggest money out there, people are not going to really have a good reason to hold on to your money, and your money is going to be constantly declining. It's a little bit like having Venezuelan bolivars or Argentinian pesos or Lebanese liras today. There's no reason to hold on to these horrible currencies that are constantly devaluing. You need to basically just hold on to dollars. And all the smart people in these countries hold on to physical dollars if they can, or USDT or Bitcoin. You know, the smart, really smart ones hold on to Bitcoin, obviously.
It's funny. I mean, I think it was yesterday, Rand Paul had submitted a proposal to balance the US budget over the next 5 years, and it was voted down 2-1, both sides of the aisle. And it looks like we've got rate cuts coming in a number of G7 countries. So we may be seeing an acceleration or a short-term acceleration of the devaluation of money. Do you think the governments really don't understand Bitcoin? Or do you think they don't care? Like there's like this general careening towards monetary implosion. I've seen you tweet that Bitcoin could represent some sort of like forced debt jubilee, as it sort of ends up swallowing all these softer monies. Like your thoughts on all that?
Yeah, I think people in governments around the world today are generally very high time preference. In other words, they're very short term in their thinking. They get into office, they've got a few years, and they are optimizing for what happens over the next quarter, the next year, so that, you know, the next election cycle, they get reelected. They can't really think very long term. So this is ultimately what, in my mind, makes them incapable of getting Bitcoin. And I'm sure you know people like that in your own life where you try and explain Bitcoin to them and it almost sounds like you're insulting them when you're telling them, you know, take money out of the money that you were going to be spending on stupid things this month and put it away so that 5 years from now, you're going to have something that is good for you. And, you know, to those people, it sounds like you're telling them, hey, I want to rob some of your fun money. You know, I want to take away your weed and booze and partying and fancy dinner restaurant money and just burn it away. Because in their mind, it doesn't register that, you know, what do I care about what's going to happen 10 years from now? 10 years from now, I'll find some way to make money then and I'll have money and then I'll worry about buying my booze and my drugs then. So it's very hard to orange pill people like that. I'm sure, you know, most Bitcoiners relate. You try and explain this to people and a lot of people just don't have a concept of saving. They don't have the concept of providing for your future self. They think that, you know, in the future, you know, I'm going to win the lottery or I'm going to get a much better paying job or I'm going to inherit money or I just, you know, I don't think about the future. I just think about the present. I've got money in my pocket right now and there are parties to go to and drugs to consume and fancy cars to buy. And the future just doesn't register. So governments are basically like that. And the people who run governments are like that. Democracy selects for people like that. You got to get into that government and optimize it over a 2, 3, 4, 5 year election cycle. So they don't really think of the long term, but their incentive is to take advantage of the money printer as much as they can. And so it's very difficult to get them to think otherwise. So, but you know, that used to be something that would frustrate people if they are into hard money, if they understand gold, if they want to fix the world, they think, you know, the only way to fix it is to go back on a gold standard. But then if people in power don't think about the long term, you're not going to get them to adopt the gold standard. And that's why it's been a completely futile attempt to try and restore the gold standard over the last century. Well, Bitcoin doesn't ask for permission and Bitcoin doesn't need those people to cooperate. On the contrary, it thrives on their high time preference and stupidity. The more of a short-term focus they have, the more money they print, the worse off their currency performs against Bitcoin, the better Bitcoin looks. The more they're advertising Bitcoin for the world, the more they tell the world to get into Bitcoin. And so more and more people are just going to be aware of the problem that Bitcoin fixes, the more governments are inflationary and they can't stop Bitcoin. So Bitcoin just continues to grow and their stupid shitcoins continue to go to zero. Now, the really interesting thing in terms of the debt jubilee, which is one of the main ideas in my second book, The Fiat Standard, is that essentially the fiat monetary system exists through the creation of debt. Fiat money exists because you create debt. Every time a bank makes a loan, new money is created. Every time a central bank buys government bonds, new money is created. So when governments borrow, when banks issue a mortgage, all of this lending stuff, it's creating new money. When businesses borrow, new money is being created. And that is why everybody needs to get into debt. Remember, we were talking about the houses earlier. If you want to buy a house, it makes a lot more sense for you to borrow, get into debt to buy the house. So therefore, everybody's constantly getting into debt in the fiat system. However, people who get into Bitcoin, they just hold on to assets and they run a positive cash balance. And so therefore, their cash balance continues to appreciate. So what happens now is that we see that debt is basically devaluing. And so over time, the value of the debt that everybody owes becomes less and less in real terms. In other words, in Bitcoin terms. As your Bitcoins appreciate, your debt depreciates. And therefore, the debt becomes less and less significant. So the way that I see this playing out in the long term, you know, a lot of the Bitcoiners like to think of, you know, there's going to be a massive hyperinflationary collapse. And I don't think that that is necessarily the case. On the contrary, I think Bitcoin can just continue to grow and fiat can continue to do what it does. Just extrapolate the last 10 years onto the next 20, you know, and you can try out different growth rates, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years into the future. At some point, all of the fiat economy and all of its debt just becomes a small rounding error next to the Bitcoin economy, because Bitcoin just continues to appreciate and fiat and its debt continues to depreciate. So at that point, all of this debt is just essentially unwound into insignificance. Rather than having a massive debt collapse, rather than having a massive global catastrophe economically, we're just going to upgrade. You know, we didn't have a catastrophe of typewriter failures in order for us to upgrade to computers and printers. We just continued to use computers and printers that they made, and they made the people who used them more productive. And so people got rid of their typewriters. And slowly and surely, typewriter companies started making fewer typewriters. And then there were fewer typewriter companies. And then the entire industry went out of business. And now everybody's using computers. I think that's what's going to happen to fiat money and fiat debt. It's just going to be phased out into insignificance as the world advances onto a more advanced monetary technology.
One of the big lies I think that we've been sold in mass is the notion that we need to continually expand the money supply and somehow it's a beneficial lubricant economically that is required to make sure that everything doesn't grind to a halt. I've seen you say, like, you know, you could run the world on $1 if it was sufficiently divisible, but I wonder if you could just take a quick stab at why that is true.
Well, because the thing about money is a unique good compared to all other goods in that it is a good that is acquired not for its quantity, not for the services that it renders. It is acquired to be exchanged. And so therefore, its quantity itself does not matter. That's why you'd rather have one US dollar than have 10 Japanese yens. It's not about the number of the money. It's about the purchasing power. And so therefore, the purchasing power is something that is irrespective of the quantity of the money. It's orthogonal to it. So you could have a lot of purchasing power in $1, or you could have very little purchasing power in $1. And what determines that is the total supply. So what determines that is the fraction of the dollar out of the total supply of money. And so therefore, it doesn't really matter how much dollars you have. What matters is how much purchasing power it contains. And so the more that the supply of the dollar grows, the more that the dollars that you have are devalued, the less the purchasing power that is stored in them. And that's what makes money different from all other goods. More apples means more people get to eat more apples. So more apples are good. More computers means more people are being able to use more computers, which is good. The more cars, homes, every good that you can think of, the more that we have, that means more people can enjoy more and more of it. And that's a good thing, except for money. It's not about having more of it. It's about having the purchasing power in it. And so therefore, any supply of money, if you keep dividing it enough, then you can keep the purchasing power inside it and you don't need to increase the supply of money. So you could run the entire world economy on $1. You just need to keep dividing the dollar down into smaller and smaller units. We'd have a millionth of a dollar and a billionth of a dollar and a trillionth of a dollar and a quadrillionth of a dollar. And that's fine. You know, you could buy your lunch with 1 trillionth of a dollar. And that is no different than buying it with $30. It's just, it's what matters is what fraction is that unit out of the total supply.
I'm assuming this might be leading into, you mentioned your new book coming out is The Gold Standard. And for listeners who might be interested, maybe just a quick overview.
Yeah, so I'm completing the trilogy. You know, my first book is The Bitcoin Standard. The second one is The Fiat Standard. The third one is The Gold Standard, although it's a little different or very different from the first two. This is, I'm inventing a new genre of books. It is an economic fiction book. I've never heard of a book like that before. But it's a fictional economic history of the 20th century, where the 20th century was spent on the gold standard. And so rather than just writing a book about the gold standard theoretically, which I think, you know, at this point is not very relevant because it's not something that we've had for about 100 years, I'd thought, you know, I'm just going to write about imagining what the world would have looked like with hard money. If you read the Bitcoin standard and the fiat standard, you see that I've found an enormous amount of problems in the world happening because of the creation of fiat money. I detail those problems, you know, the fact that there's inflation, it's constantly robbing people of value, it's making the world poorer. And I think to imagine just how devastating fiat money has been over the 20th century is really depressing. So what I'm doing with this book is imagining what we could have had if we hadn't been on the fiat standard, if we'd had gold as money. I think there'd have been a lot fewer wars. There would have been a lot less devastation from wars because the governments would be forced to be a lot more responsible when the way that they behave, when they have to earn their money rather than just print it, and you can't print gold. And so I go through a thought experiment where, you know, fiat money came into existence in 1914, effectively, when the Bank of England and the major central banks suspended redemption of gold. And unfortunately, they still haven't resumed the redemption. Here we are 111 years later.
Nothing is more temporary government measure.
Exactly. It's just one of those temporary 111 years and counting measures. But in my book, I just come up with a, I believe, believable and plausible story for why this wouldn't have worked out. And in 1915, it could have fallen apart, basically. And if it falls apart, then we just go through a very elaborate thought experiment of what the world would have looked like. And the way it falls apart is because people discover, you know, before the war starts, somebody had built a gold monetary clearance system based on airplanes that allows people to move gold around without having to go through central banks. It's essentially a Bitcoin, an analog Bitcoin with gold. You run airplanes that fly Bitcoin around. That's how airplanes take off initially as an industry. That's how they scale. They're used for clearing gold. And so then when the central banks start confiscating everybody's gold, people have an alternative to central banks. And so the central banks' currencies collapse. And then the world gets to live happily ever after. And World War I ends in 1915, and we live in peace and prosperity. That's the premise of the book.
Cool. I'll look forward to reading that. I've had some of these thoughts as well. I wonder, you know, I mean, a lot of the most beautiful buildings in the world that we travel around see just sort of imminently predate 1915. And yeah. I cannot but wonder, though, if John Maynard Keynes might have actually been the inventor of economic fiction, but maybe that's a different discussion.
He does feature in the book because he had a role to play in the creation of fiat money in 1915. You know, he became famous in the 20s and 30s, but in 1915, he was there. And so he does feature in the book. I'm not going to spoil it for you.
Thanks again so much for coming on the show to share some of your ideas. And for our listeners, if we could point them anywhere else, is there anywhere else we'd like to send them?
Yeah, my website, safeddean.com, where you can sign up for my courses based on my books. And then there's thesafehouse.com, where you can buy my books and other books on economics and Bitcoin, thesafehouse.com. And I'm on Twitter as well, @safeddean.
Awesome. Thank you again. And if you're listening and you made it all the way to the end of the episode, I want to thank you as well for tuning in and hope to see you next week.
All right, man. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. Block Rewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits, supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies, and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and BMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.